From the Free Press, this is Honestly, and I'm Barry Weiss. If you're listening to this or watching it, you probably know somebody who has struggled with alcohol addiction. Or maybe you're an alcoholic yourself. It is one of the most universal human experiences. In 2023, 10% of the population in America met the criteria for alcoholism. That's 30 million people. And for the past 100 years or so, there's basically been one solution: total sobriety, talk therapy, and Alcoholics Anonymous. And yes, there are countless people ready and eager to say, AA saved my life. I know and love many of those people myself. I'm sure you do too. But as Katie Herzog writes in her new book, the dominance of AA obscures the fact that other options exist too. Okay, it sounds almost too good to be true. What's this other option? It's a drug called naltrexone that can let alcoholics keep drinking. Yes, you heard me right. Katie describes it as a chemical safety net, one that makes you want to drink less. Yes, drink so you can drink less. Stay with me. In order for the drug to work, you actually have to drink, or at least you do in the beginning. The goal in this method is not necessarily total abstinence. It's reformed, moderate, responsible drinking. Now, does this sound like snake oil to you, or even dangerous advice? I get it. More than 175,000 Americans die each year from excessive drinking. It causes heart disease, cancer, domestic violence, suicide, and just human misery. It costs the U.S. economy nearly $250 billion in healthcare expenses. And there's, of course, loss of productivity, vehicle wrecks. I could go on. If you lived with someone with alcoholism, or if you've been close to someone who struggles with addiction, you know how devastating it can be. So when someone comes along and says, your alcoholic loved one can actually drink with naltrexone, perhaps your knee-jerk reaction is to say, hell no. But in her new book, Drink Your Way Sober, Katie Herzog argues that AA and our traditional thinking has not worked and will not work for everyone. And she makes the case that we should be much more open to alternative forms of treatment like naltrexone and other drugs coming onto the market that simply didn't exist when AA was founded. I hope you know Katie's name from this show in the past and also from her hit podcast, Blocked and Reported. She technically co-hosts it with a guy called Jesse Single, but she likes to say she is the only host of the only podcast. Today, I ask Katie how she got sober after years and years of alcoholism by using naltrexone and a method called the Sinclair Method. We talk about how the drug actually works, why it's been so shunned by the medical community, and whether she thinks alcoholics, not just her, can buy into it. Stay with us. This is going to be maybe a little bit like a very public AA meeting. We're going to talk about your past drinking, your rock bottom, why you're sober. But this time, we're not going to be in a church basement with cookies and, I presume, coffee. It's going to be in front of the entire Honestly audience. Are you ready?
I'm ready. No smoke breaks on this one.
Okay. So, Katie, take us down memory lane, if you would. And by memory lane, I mean your history of drinking. When did you start drinking alcohol?
I had my first drink when I was 12 or 13. So pretty young. I wasn't, you know, Gen Z, staying at home, scrolling on my phone. I was an active member of society, out drinking with my adolescent friends, pre-adolescent friends. When I was in school, and I don't know, you know, I grew up in a rural area, so I don't know if this was your experience in Pittsburgh, but we went to keg parties, you know, like in people's farms. This wasn't in the suburbs, but someone's family or parents would be out of town. And so we'd go out to the pasture and like get a keg and burn tires. You know, this was growing up in Western North Carolina. So I did a lot of that in high school. And then in college, I loved college. College was for me, academics were a very minor part of my college experience. Went to a state school. And I drank. That was mostly what I did. I loved to sit on my porch by myself and drank during the day and read the New Yorker. That was my favorite thing to do. And in fact, if the New Yorker were still great, it might still be my favorite thing to do today. So I drank a lot in college. And then after college, you know, my friends, they started to move away from that lifestyle gradually. Not all of them, but many of them did. You know, they moved away from where we went to college. They got jobs, careers, later families, got married, had kids. And I just didn't do those things. I stayed at the bar. And I was a barfly. I was a young dykey barfly from a young age. And I loved it. I loved to be in smoky bars with people who were sometimes twice my age, talking about politics, talking about culture, whatever. And I did that for years. I did that for really almost two decades.
It sounds sort of idyllic, but also lonely, sitting on the porch, drinking a bunch of beers, reading the New Yorker alone. Talk to us about, was this like, you know, a solitary thing for you or a social thing for you or both? Or like, you know, when people describe alcoholism, a lot of them describe like, you know, the sort of shame of getting blasted alone. But for you, it sounds like it was kind of like a happy and social thing.
It was both. So in my 20s and earlier 30s, I was a barfly. So I would go to the bar, and I had, you know, particular locals that I loved. I would go to the bar every day, oftentimes, you know, at 4 p.m. when the bar opened, and I would stay there drinking not until last call. I generally didn't make it from 4 until 2 a.m. That would have been quite a long shift. Sometimes I did, but that would be a special occasion. But then I would leave and I would go home and I would drink more by myself. And then in my later years, my drinking was entirely solitary. It was secretive. It wasn't social at all. I was by myself drinking alone. Nobody knew, including my wife.
Tell us a little bit, though, Katie, like, what were you like when you're drinking? Happy drunk, angry drunk, chaotic drunk, all of the above?
Yeah. I was very fun. And I think it surprises people who know me in this stage of my life to hear that I was fun, because I'm not fun anymore. And I think it surprises people who knew me in that stage of life, in my fun days, to hear that I'm not fun anymore, because I was so fun. I was really active. I was very social. I went out every night. I had so many friends. I was popular. I'll just say it. I was fucking cool. But that
those of us who know you now are shocked to know that.
Shocked, yes.
But there were also, you know, and you share these stories in your incredible new book, but, you know, stories about climbing cranes, biking and drinking, ending up in the ER, burning down a port. Like, can you give us a sense of some of the, hijinks seems like too soft a word, but some of the things that you got into?
Well, at the time it did seem like hijinks, you know, this was in my 20s, and I had a lot of like just misadventures, and I was incredibly lucky. Like, I never got in trouble with the law. I did end up in the ER. I snuck out. I basically left, took the IV out of my own arm and just walked out. I did burn down a porch. Yes, that's true. And all of these things at the time, you know, there would be this sort of acute moment of shame and worry about myself. But really quickly, it turned funny. And that's the thing about drink, because I was surrounded by drinkers. No one in my life ever sat me down and said, look, dude, this isn't cool. This is dangerous. You're going to hurt somebody. Everybody was kind of on the same page, like, okay, you're kind of a screw up, but you're also providing us with some hilarious stories. Mm-hmm. And also, I was surrounded by people who were like me. So I was not the worst of the young drinkers by any means.
But you describe sort of your cohort from college moving on away from the porch or the bar and having families, getting jobs. Like, talk to me about the way that it maybe stunted your growth and like how it impacted your career, your relationships, the things that people started to move toward that maybe you missed out on.
Yeah, I really did not. I floundered in terms of career until I was in my 30s. So I worked entry-level jobs. I worked dead-end jobs. I worked as a receptionist at a hair salon. I was a barista for many years. I worked at Whole Foods. eventually I would get fired or quit unceremoniously all of these jobs because it's really hard to have a job that requires you to wake up at even 9 o'clock in the morning, 8:30 in the morning when you are hungover every day of your life. So career-wise, I was very stunted, but I was also lucky because this was happening in an era and I was in cities where in towns where rent was still pretty cheap. So I could manage to work part-time and still pay my bar tab. In terms of relationships, same thing. You know, I dated a lot. I had plenty of relationships, but they were pretty boozy. And I would say in retrospect, not particularly healthy relationships.
Did you make a connection in your mind between working these dead-end jobs that weren't really they weren't really a career and the drinking
at the
time?
They weren't a podcast.
Or exactly. You had not yet come into full bloom as a wilderness lesbian with a gun and a podcast. No, but like, let's be real. Like, you're one of the great writers. You really are.
Thank you.
Lazy. You're lazy, unfortunately, because you could be doing a lot more. But you're one of the great writers. And like, the idea that you should be working a checkout line at a grocery store just has no relationship to the gifts you've been given. At the time that you're working these dead-end jobs, did you understand, like, did you make the connection in your mind between the drinking and the jobs, or no?
I don't think so. And I was writing at the time, so I kept a blog. And this has been taken offline and scrubbed from the Internet Archive, so nobody try to find it. You won't. But I kept a blog. My first forays into writing were blogging about my misadventures. So in a way, all of this kind of provided content for me. It gave me something to write about. But I wasn't in denial. I wasn't in full-time denial about the problems that drinking were causing in my life. And in fact, I tried many times during this period to quit drinking, but it seemed like such an impossible task.
I think the thing that is sort of maybe it's not unusual, but it's certainly unusual compared to a lot of the people I know who were alcoholics and got sober, which is that you're a very high-functioning alcoholic. Like, through this, you get married to a wonderful person, you go into journalism, and your drinking continues. It just becomes very secretive, which is an aspect of this story that fascinates me because I'm incapable of keeping a secret. And I also spend all of my time with Nelly, who would like the idea of having an affair or anything
right.
really that's secretive.
Right.
It would be so impossible in my life. So A, I want to understand how you managed to kind of pull off this getting to the next step without actually becoming sober. Usually people get sober and then they're kind of like real productive life launches. You manage to do both at the same time, or at least it seems that way. And then I secondly want to hear about how you kept this a secret, because that part is amazing to me. So first of all, how did you like get the job, get the wife without becoming sober?
That part, people are always sort of surprised about that part, but like I worked at an alt weekly. You know, I wasn't working at the New York Times. I was working at the Seattle Stranger. Like, people can manage to be alcoholics at the Stranger and do manage to be alcoholics at the Stranger for many years, for much longer than I did. You know, it wasn't that difficult. I don't know. The years that were harder were the years when I was going like a barfly and I was staying up late at night. Those years, it would have been really hard to have a career because drinking took up so much of my time. But in the later years, it just wasn't that hard because so much of my drinking was private and at home by myself that I could drink in the afternoon and be done with it by 8 p.m., you know, you're in bed at 9. The sleep might not be great, but you're up at 8 the next day and you still got, you know, that's still 11 hours. And it does, yes, it does keep 11 hours to keep this machine running. In terms of relationships too, just none of this was that hard. People, and having written this book, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people who would be classified as alcoholics for my book. a lot of people do much more impressive things, much boozier. And then if you, you know, if you look back in history, you know, my grandfather was worked in Manhattan during the sort of Mad Men era. He was part of that generation that was having three martini lunches. People do it, you know? It's not like
I don't know how. Like, unless, right, but like, unless you're British, like, and I'm fully convinced that there's something different genetically with, you know, people of British stock, like they seem to be able to just hold liquor in a way that, well, maybe it's Jewish Americans, but people here cannot.
Okay, I am of Irish stock, so maybe that explains part of that.
Yeah. Tell us about though a typical day. Like you're working at the Stranger, you are married to your wife, and you're heavily drinking. Like when are you drinking, and like how's it working, and what are you telling? What are you telling your wife?
So a typical day when I was working at the Stranger, I would not have been drinking because I didn't drink at work. So I would have, on a typical day, I would have gone to work, left, gone home, and not be drinking. During that period when I was working at the Stranger, I was going on benders. So like if my wife was work, she's a nurse. If she was working a late shift at work or working at night or something, then instead of going home, because I never wanted her to know how much I was drinking. Not that she would have like had a problem. I mean, she might have had a little bit of a problem with it if she knew how much, but she wasn't the type of person who I knew was going to leave me over something like this. I was never worried about that. And at the time I was working at the Stranger, we weren't married yet. But if she was not around, I would leave the paper and I would go to a bar and I would sit there. And this was not a very social period of my life. And this was Seattle, which is not a particularly social city. And also cell phones exist. So sit at a bar and just scroll my phone. Like this isn't, it wasn't exciting. It wasn't fun. There wasn't hijinks. There wasn't misadventures. It was pretty boring. So, you know, drink for 3 or 4 hours, go home, take a shower, choke down some food, and be in bed when Jana got home. It became much more problematic during COVID. And by that point, I was gone from the paper and I was at home by myself. Mm. So we had moved. We moved about an hour outside of Seattle. This was, you know, less than a year before COVID. When COVID happened, I got furloughed from the paper immediately. And then later that became a permanent layoff. So that's when things really accelerated. So during that period that I was working at the Stranger, my drinking was way more in check. It was COVID that things kind of accelerated into like very kind of scary, problematic levels.
For people who think, who kind of have a caricature in their mind about like an alcoholic is someone who wakes up in the morning, starts drinking, drinks throughout the day, and hears you say, there were days, maybe even whole weeks where you weren't drinking and then maybe have a bender on the weekend. Explain to the person who's like, well, I do that and I don't consider myself an alcoholic.
Yeah. I think that those people might not be alcoholics. For me, the defining feature of my addiction was mental obsession. So I had a compulsion to drink. I had a overwhelming mental obsession. And I there's a term that I actually heard your sister Susie say on Noam Dorman's podcast when talking about Ozempic. She used the term food noise. And that's what it was like. It was booze noise. And the booze noise never, ever stopped. For 20 years, the noise never stopped. Always in the back of my mind was this question, when can I drink? Can I drink? Knowing I shouldn't drink. That was the defining feature of it. It wasn't how it got in the way of my life, my job, my relationships, whatever. It was obsession. The closest thing I think I could compare it to is love, is new love. When you've got this like real intense crush on another person, and that's the only thing you can think about, and it feels sort of crazy and obsessive.
But it's the best feeling in the entire world.
Right. But turn that into a substance that's killing you. You know, it's sort of the toxic inverse of that. But just that level of obsession, that's what addiction was for me. And so if people drink, I'm sure there are many people who drink more than I did who do not feel like it's, that they are addicted, who do not feel like it's impacting their life negatively. That's fine. Those people might not have a problem. But for me, it was just, I wanted that noise to stop, and it did not stop for years and years and years.
So COVID sort of accelerates all of this. You're out of work. The whole world is shut down. Mm-hmm. A lot of people I know drank a lot. I mean, I ate and drank a huge amount during COVID. Mm-hmm. And there are pictures on the internet to prove that. A lot of people like to use one in particular, which is very, very mean. But was there a moment where you kind of said to yourself, like, I must get sober. I need to get sober. You know, in AA speak, it would be like, what was your bottom? Like, tell us that moment or moments.
I had that moment literally every day. So, you know, people ask me how often how many times did you try to quit? The answer to that is thousands. I tried to quit every single day. And every single day I would wake up and I would tell myself, today will be different. Today you are not going to drink. And 3 hours later, I'm out the door walking to the store to get, you know, my daily rations. But there were some incidents that made it harder to kind of ignore that something deeply problematic was wrong. And I was not in denial about this at this point in my life at all. I had gone through this for years and years. And by COVID, with just sort of all the guardrails off, like up until that time, I had enough structure with work and with my relationship to keep myself sane. And then with COVID, with that gone, it was just like the worst impulses came out. I just gave in to all of those impulses. I was also probably tweeting, you know, I don't know how many times a day during this period, just getting loaded and tweeting. It was a great life.
Jesus, Katie.
and I have now quit both of those things. I don't know which has a bigger impact on my life, really. But there was one incident that I think when you're looking for a rock bottom that would maybe qualify. So I was a blackout drinker. And I drank during the day during COVID because I only drank when Jana was at work. And she would work long hours. She's a nurse. So she would be gone for, you know, long periods of the day. Also, our commute was very long. So she could be gone for, you know, 14, 15 hours a day during this period. And so that was my drinking hours. And there was one day when she came home late and I would drink during the day. And then by the time she got home in the evening, you know, I don't know if I had totally sobered up, but I had showered, I had eaten something, and I smoked pot during this period too. So I think any sort of blurriness in my eyes could be attributed to that. But there was one period where I must have drank in longer than normal. I fell asleep. I passed out in bed. And in the night, I got up, Jana woke up, and I walked into towards our bathroom, but the bathroom door was shut for some reason. And I walked into it, and I hit it with my face, just walked into the bathroom door, and then walked outside, walked out our back door into our backyard, and dropped my shorts and just started peeing in the yard. I had I was not conscious when this was happening. And I came to when Jana was shaking my shoulder, like, what are you doing? And, you know, then she chalked it up to sleepwalking. But I was blackout, you know, I was blackout drunk. So that was probably a low. But it was, again, you know, the next day, it's also kind of funny, you know? And that's the thing about all of my various rock bottoms over the years. In retrospect, like, no one was hurt. I wasn't arrested. I wasn't drunk driving. Had my neighbors looked out the window, they would have been confused. But luckily my neighbors were very old, so they might not have even noticed what was going on. So that was, you know, that was one incident, but most of my drinking in those years was much more pedestrian. I wasn't doing anything that caused real lasting harm, except for maybe the tweets.
So are they now forever erased?
Yes.
Like your blog from your early days?
Okay. Everything is erased.
Wow, Katie. So you try and stop. I mean, every day you're trying to stop. But then you kind of do the thing that everyone does, which is you go to AA. Tell us about that experience.
So I started going to AA many years ago. I went to my first meetings when I was 24 years old. And I did not like AA. I didn't like to think of myself as an alcoholic, and to say those words aloud, which you do in meetings, was painful, humiliating. I didn't feel like one of those people. I didn't like the spiritual aspect of it. I didn't like that one of the tenets of AA is that you admit that you are powerless over the substance. I didn't want to feel powerless. I wanted to feel in control, which I wasn't, but I wanted to feel that way. I didn't like the people. They were so fucking happy to be sober. I found that very resentful. I was very, I thought they were lying. I didn't like reading the book, the big book. I thought the writing was bad. You know, it was, I hated every aspect of it. And I was just resentful of the fact that this I thought was my future, that if I wanted to get sober, I was going to have to go to these meetings every day. And oftentimes I would go to meetings and then I would go to a bar right afterwards. They made me thirsty. But I went periodically throughout the years. During COVID, I did AA on Zoom. I did some Zoom meetings, which were, you know, even, I think, less compelling than the in-person ones. I mean, some AA can be quite amusing. There, as you would expect, there are some great storytellers in those meetings. And then they tell the same story the next day, oftentimes. Now I appreciate AA, and I go occasionally now just to sort of drop in and check in, see how it feels. But at the time, I was just so resentful of it.
I think the critique people have who read your book and have read other things you've written about the treatment that did work for you, and we're going to get to that in a second, is that you didn't really like commit to AA. You didn't get a sponsor. Mm-hmm. You didn't really contribute in meetings. Do you think that if you had fully kind of thrown yourself into it, it would have worked for you?
I don't think it would have worked for me because of my sort of my personality. So I'm a skeptic, right? And like, I'm the person who would
disagreeable
yes.
skeptic.
Yes, I'm really unpleasant to be around. In other words, yes. Like, I'm the sort of person who would be in AA, I'd be Googling recidivism rates and trying to poke holes into why this wasn't going to work for me. Like, I'm just not a joiner. But, and the other thing is, but the main thing is AA was, for me, unable to address the fundamental problem for me, which was that I wanted to drink. AA didn't take the desire away. It didn't take the cravings away. It didn't take the urge away. And so going to meetings, you know, now I really appreciate AA, the structure, the support, the community, the accountability, providing a place to go and doing this all for free. I think AA is an incredible program. You know, it's saved millions of lives worldwide. I don't knock AA in the book. I don't knock AA in real life. But for me, I had this physical addiction and I had this emotional addiction. I had urges to drink that just could not be satiated by talk, by going to meetings, by going to talk therapy, by smart recovery or moderation management. I just had this physical urge that was so overwhelming that no kind of behavioral therapy could address.
So like, the conventional wisdom and the wisdom that is very much put forward by AA is that the only way to overcome addiction to alcohol and drugs is total abstinence. Like, that is what it requires. And you say, maybe not.
AA itself is a little bit more nuanced on this question. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what AA is and what the big book says. AA is a little bit less dogmatic than you would sort of imagine, at least sort of the official programming. They take no position on outside programs. Bill Wilson, the founder of the program, was extremely open-minded himself. He did LSD with Timothy Leary in the 1950s. But the message that I got from the culture was that, yes, there is one path out of addiction, and that is abstinence forever. You know, they say it's one day at a time, but really everybody knows they mean it forever. And that just, the problem with that for me was that I didn't want to quit. And I wanted to quit, but I couldn't quit. And if the only way out of that was to do this thing that seemed so unimaginable, so painful, so impossible, I just wasn't going to do it. And so that messaging kept me drinking longer than I should have because I thought that was the only option. Quit. That's it. Quit. Just never do this again.
Well, you found another way, and it's captured in the provocative title of your new book, Drink Your Way Sober, The Science-Based Method to Break Free from Alcohol. A lot of people are going to hear that and say, what the hell is this woman talking about? Mm-hmm. So tell us about the Sinclair Method and tell us about this kind of magical drug that I had never heard about until I started reading your work on this topic.
Yeah, the Sinclair method was developed by an American researcher who did most of his work in Finland. His name is John David Sinclair. And this is something that I think any alcoholic or any problem drinker can probably, might not know the name for, but would recognize, which is the fact that after a period of extended abstinence, maybe it's a few weeks, maybe it's a few months, you might think that that makes the cravings, the urge for alcohol to go away. And in reality, it actually gets stronger. So in this case, in the case of alcohol, abstinence literally does make the heart grow fonder. And he wanted some way to interrupt that pattern, right? So you've had this period of sobriety and all of a sudden you've got this urge to drink. And that's what he wanted to address as a way to eliminate the desire, the craving for alcohol. And so he started doing his early studies on lab rats. And he would give these lab rats opioid, various drugs, but the one that he found to be particularly effective was an opioid blocker called naltrexone. Naltrexone was developed in the 1960s by a pharmaceutical company called Endo Labs. They were later acquired by DuPont. And this drug was initially developed not to treat alcohol use disorder, but opioid use disorder. And it works like this. It blocks the pleasurable response that the brain gets from opioids or alcohol. In the case of alcohol, so people are affected, different people are affected differently by alcohol, but when I drink alcohol, I get an endorphin rush, right? It doesn't sedate me, it doesn't make me sleepy. The first drink makes me high, energized, social, chatty, way more fun than I am sober. And naltrexone blocks that effect. So the way that naltrexone is commonly prescribed in the United States is if you go to your doctor, and you say you're having trouble with drinking, your doctor will, in all likelihood, well, if they know about this drug, if they prescribe the drug for you, they'll tell you to take it every day. Get up in the morning, take this drug, it'll cut your cravings. And that does work for some people. But Dr. Sinclair, he developed this really unique way of prescribing the drug. And he wasn't a clinician himself, he was a researcher. But the Sinclair method is basically this. You take an opioid blocker, typically naltrexone, although there are other ones. And then you wait an hour, at least an hour, which is how long it takes to metabolize, and then you drink as normal. And if you do this over time, you're not getting that pleasurable response from alcohol. His theory was sort of this. Alcoholism, problem drinking, is a learned behavior. You can unlearn that behavior. And that's what this drug does. It severs the association between pleasure and drinking. So when you're drinking, you can still get drunk, but you don't get buzz. You don't get the high associated with alcohol. So when I drink alcohol on naltrexone, I feel sort of down, low energy, sleepy, kind of depressed. And the Sinclair method, as he developed it, if you do this, every time that you drink, you will either, ideally, this doesn't work for anybody, you will drink less, and over time, you will lose the desire for alcohol. And losing the desire for alcohol, that's a point of extinction, what he called pharmacological extinction. So using a medication to reach this state of unlearning.
How did you find out about this as an alternative to AA? Like, again, I had never heard about this before you.
It was an article in The Atlantic that came out in 2015 by Gabrielle Glasser. It was called The Irrationality of Alcoholics Anonymous. And most of her piece was about why AA fails as often as it does. And again, AA works for millions of people, but it doesn't work for everyone. But there was this section in the piece about the Sinclair method. So she went to Finland and she met Dr. Sinclair. And when I read that, I thought, this is what I have been looking for. This is the cure to my problem. This is going to save me. And I read that years ago, years before COVID. And I took the article to my doctor and I got a prescription for naltrexone. And I walked home. This was when I was living in Seattle. And I stopped by, you know, my local liquor store and I got a can of shitty beer. And I went home and I took my pill and I waited an hour. And then I started drinking and I felt awful. I felt so sick. And I thought, I had side effects. It didn't feel good. I didn't like anything about it. And I thought, oh, this is not going to be the thing that cures me. So I put it away. I just, you know, hid it in a drawer somewhere. And I kept drinking at that point, I think 4 more years before I tried it again.
Okay, and then you try it again, and then what happens?
Yeah, so during COVID, I got to the point in my drinking where I knew I had to do something. And my options as I saw it were come clean, you know, tell Jana, go to rehab, and then 90 meetings in 90 days. It was going to be so disruptive to my life. I had a podcast I had to run, and I don't think, you know, I called Hazel and Betty Ford, and they said it was going to be like $30,000, and I was going to have to go to Minnesota for a month. And I was like, can you podcast in rehab? And they said no. And I was like, well, can't do
the
that.
The public would not be able to live. We needed Barbot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go on.
So, and I also, I thought my
so
wife
rehab
would
was
notice.
Out of the question.
Rehab was out.
Yeah. Shoot,
and this was
shoot.
Like, yeah. And I was like, well, if I'm going to go to rehab, I want to go to like a rehab, like in Malibu. I don't want to go to Minnesota, but I couldn't afford it. So rehab was out and I didn't want Jana to know. And, you know, I was doing Zoom meetings. I was trying every day not to drink, but I just had these overwhelming cravings that I would always give into because I have very, very little willpower. I have a lot of willpower when it comes to like not exercising. I'm very good at not doing that, but not drinking, much harder. And so, but I had this prescription, you know, hidden somewhere in a drawer. And I thought, okay, I'm going to try this one more time. And if this works, great. And if not, I'm going to have to come clean. And I will go to rehab if I have to, if this is what it takes. But let me just try one more thing before I do that.
And what happened?
So this time, I did it differently this time. I armed myself with information. So I was prepared the second time around for the side effects. So naltrexone is typically prescribed in 50 milligram pills. I cut it into a fourth. So I started out with a really low dose. I took it with a full, you know, full meal. I drank a full glass of water. So I was prepared to experience some side effects. And this is really important. Not everyone gets side effects on naltrexone. I've talked to dozens of people who have taken this drug, and those of us who do are, I think, in the minority. And the side effects themselves, for me, weren't that severe. It was a little bit of stomach upset, headachey. Mostly, I just felt very tired, and I had this, like, strange compulsion to yawn all the time. It was, and, like, yawn and stretch. It was weird. But so I did everything I could to minimize the side effects. There are some people who microdose naltrexone before taking a full dose. So you take just a sliver of a pill. You can make a little solution for yourself. You basically dissolve a pill in 50 milliliters of distilled water, and then you take a few drops on your tongue. I did that a few times. That was helpful. So I was way more prepared now in terms of what to expect. I spent a lot of time in Facebook groups for the Sinclair Method. There's a book called The Cure, which was written by a friend and colleague of John David Sinclair's. It's by Roy Escapa. I read that book. The actor, Claudia Christian, she's sort of the patron saint of the Sinclair Method. It saved her life, and she has an organization called Option Save Lives, which provides coaching and support for people doing this. She's written two memoirs. I read her books. So I had way more knowledge this time around. So the first time I took the pill, you know, I started out with a low dose, ate the full meal, set my alarm for an hour, went and putzed around the house for an hour, probably mostly scrolled really. And then I started drinking. I had my first drink on naltrexone. And the effect was immediate pretty quickly. So normally when I drank, there's a couple of parts that were really pleasurable. And the first part actually comes before the drinking. That's the anticipation of drinking, right? And I get this energy, this endorphin dump, you know, dopamine is surging in my brain. And then there's the first sips of the drinks. And that's when you get sort of the first beer, the first drink. That's when you get sort of the perfect high, right? Maybe the first two drinks. Mm-hmm. And then after that, slowly, you know, it wears off. And I would spend the rest of the drinking session chasing that high, which of course doesn't really work, but you drink more and more and more to try to chase that initial buzz. And that was dulled. So the anticipation was still there. I was excited about this, particularly because I was doing something different. But that urge, that pull from the first drink and the second drink and the second drink to the third drink, that was muted. I didn't have that kind of, I don't know, that this overwhelming desire to keep drinking and to seek out that high. But I was a habitual drinker, so I still, that first session, this is called an extinction session, I drank five or six drinks that first one. So not,
oh, wow.
Yeah, not a huge decline. But I did this, I committed to this, right? So I was going to do this every time that I drank. That's really key in the process. If you skip doses, you give your brain, the hope that you can recreate that buzz and your brain will continue to chase it. I was tracking my drinks. So every time I would write it on a drink track, like a drink tracking app. I could see a visualization of how my drinking was progressed over time. And so in the first month, I would say my drinking, it slowly declined, but there were spikes and valleys, right? And this is really common in the Sinclair method. If you look at a chart, oftentimes there's peaks and valleys. It's not this linear process. But over time, gradually I could see that my drinking was getting, I was drinking less. I increased the number of alcohol-free days I had every week. That's another really important part of this process. This is what the thing that makes the Sinclair method different from taking naltrexone every day is that you only take it on days when you're actually drinking and on days when you're not drinking. So these are days when your opioid receptors are unblocked. Then you're supposed to try to do other things to create this sort of natural sense of well-being and pleasure. So getting exercise, good conversation, eating good food, you're trying to create new pathways in your brain. And so I was really regimented about it. You know, I would do my extinction sessions every week, drinking hopefully less every time, write down, track my drinks, and then on days off, take Moose my dog for hikes and paddleboard and stuff like that, just to try to do things that made me have a sense of pleasure outside of booze.
And Katie, how long did this take? So the first time you take the sliver of the pill and you're drinking whatever, 4, 5, 6 beers, mm-hmm. how long did it take to get to one or none at all?
I actively did this for 7 months. And over the 7 months, again, spikes and valleys. So sometimes I would unexpectedly drink more than I thought. But gradually I was drinking less. Month over month, I was drinking less every time. Not huge amounts different. Like, it took about 3 months until I was like, okay, now I'm seeing real reductions. And at 7 months, I decided I was going to take a month off. So I took that month off. And taking a month off before I started the Sinclair method was a painful experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I would do like dry January every once in a while or something like that. And by the end of the month, my desire to drink is so strong. You know, I'm going to celebrate. I've done so well. I'm going to celebrate with a bender, you know?
Yeah.
But this time it was just sort of easy. You know, if I did get the craving to drink, I would think, you know, well, I'd have to take the pill and I don't really like the way the pill makes me feel. And I'd have to leave my house and I'd have to put on pants and shoes. So I'm just not going to do it. It was as though sort of the rational part of my brain had come back online where I was able to see consequences. Mm. And the consequence of drinking, of taking the pill and drinking just outweighed my desire to do it. So that month was just, it was easy. And then I just never started again. So it's been 3 years and I haven't had a drink. And the really miraculous thing about this is that I haven't had the desire to have a drink. I'm free from the prison of addiction. I sound like a preacher when I say this, but it's true. This is the sensation. I actually wanted to call the book Get Free because that is the sensation that I have. Alcohol has no pull on me. It is as though I never started drinking in the first place. I do not desire it. I do not think about it.
That will strike, I think, a lot of people as kind of unbelievable because mm-hmm. even people that haven't had a drink in 10 years, people that have been sober for a long time, like now that you're a boring, unfun lesbian living in the woods, like yeah. It's not as if your memory, it's not like you were eternal sunshine of the spotless minded. Like you can still remember the before. You can remember fun Katie mm-hmm. and like the fun and the pleasure of sitting on that porch, you know, before the New Yorker got shitty, drinking. drinking alcohol, like, where does that go? Like, the memory of that and the nostalgia for that. Like, how is that part shut off? That's the part that's fascinating to me. Because this drug can't get rid of your memories.
No. Luckily, I have a terrible memory in the first place, so that's probably from the weed more than the booze. You know, I can think back on those times fondly, but now when I think back on drinking, I don't remember the good times. I remember the secrecy and the shame. And the later years of my drinking were not fun years. These were, I was sitting at my house by myself during COVID, like scrolling on my phone and working on a podcast. Like these were not high times. So it's not hard to remember those, but also I don't think about it. That's the biggest difference is between, I think, something like AA, I'm not fighting the cravings because my brain has been retrained. It feels like a very fundamental chemical difference versus what happens in AA, which is a lot of people, hopefully most people, gradually get over the urges, and they have this spiritual experience and their lives are totally different. Their identities are different. And that's just not my experience. I honestly do not feel like I am in recovery, because that is an active verb. I feel as though I have recovered. And I think a lot of people who have been in the rooms, who've been through 12 steps, hear me say this and say, you are psychotic. This is crazy. This is hubristic. It's not right. This cannot be true. But that is the experience that I have had. And I interviewed dozens of people from my book. And this is not an uncommon experience for people who have done it through naltrexone.
The feeling of freedom.
Freedom.
So, Katie, given how, I don't want to use the word miraculous, but pretty unbelievable this treatment seems, I'm struck by the fact that almost nobody I know has heard of it before you, and that even you describe sort of like bringing the Atlantic article from 2015 to your doctor, and presumably he or she, you needed to do that because maybe he or she had never heard of it either. Yep. Why is that? Why is this not more widespread if it's as effective as you're describing?
So there are a few reasons for this. I think the fundamental one is medical education. So for decades, for generations, medical education has basically ignored addiction medicine outside of specialists. So the frontline doctors who most of us see, so general practitioners, family doctors, ER doctors, have not gotten trained in addiction medicine. I talk to doctors whose only training in, 4 years of med school, 4 years of residency, and whatever other training they did beyond that, their only education on alcoholism would have been to attend one AA meeting. So they just weren't getting educated on the drugs, FDA-approved drugs to treat alcohol use disorder. So there are three drugs, including naltrexone. Naltrexone has been approved by the FDA to treat alcohol use disorder for over 30 years, and yet they were not getting trained on that. And this is changing. So now med students all learn about these drugs in their psych rotation. They're tested on it on their medical boards. So that's one reason. Another reason is financial incentives, right? So the patent for naltrexone expired in the 90s. Companies are not marketing this drug for the most part because they could just be undercut by the drug manufacturer down the street. So there's no financial incentive to do so. That is sort of changing now. So New Yorkers might have seen these ads for a company called Or. I'm hearing a lot of people mention these ads. And this is a company that does telehealth specializing in naltrexone. And they just released a drug that is patented. It's called Clutch. I haven't tried it, so I can't vouch for it. But it's a mint. It's a faster acting naltrexone mint, which I think is really exciting. So you could take this. You don't have to wait the full hour until you drink. I think the wait is 30 minutes. You take this mint. It's supposed to cut down on side effects, and then you can go to the bar. I like that idea also because it seems less sort of medicalized. It's not a pill, it's a mint. Slightly different, right? So they have a financial incentive, right? They have patented it. I don't know how much it costs, but you have to, for a drug like this that is generic, you have to tweak it to make it valuable, basically. And they have done that. So I'm excited about that. And there's also cultural issues here, right? So in the US, the dominant form of dealing with alcoholism for the last almost 100 years has been AA and 12-step programs. And the Sinclair method is anathema to AA because you continue to drink while you are on the drug. Naltrexone is less anathema because if you're just taking the drug and you're not drinking, that's not going to be sort of against the tenets of AA. But there has been resistance within the program to medication. AA was founded in the 1930s. The big book was written in the 1930s. These drugs didn't exist then. Bill Wilson himself, the founder, was so open-minded. I think that he would have approved of this sort of treatment. He knew that there was more than one way to get people sober. I think he would have been absolutely fine with this. But there has been some hesitation. And I think there's also something else going on as well, which is that Addiction causes so much chaos and pain in the culture and families and society. You know, the messaging has changed. People oftentimes will say it's a disease, but we treat it like it's a moral failing still. And if something is a moral failing, you kind of want people to be punished for it, right? I think oftentimes people think that that recovery should be painful. It is necessarily painful because it causes so much pain to other people. Shouldn't you be punished? I think what they're not realizing is that addiction itself is painful. Addiction is hell. You have already gone through the pain. And so in my thinking, what we should do is make it as easy as possible, not as hard as possible, as easy as possible, so that more people are able to recover from their addictions, whether that's moderately drinking, which some people do on naltrexone, or complete sobriety, which is what I did. And then the other thing is, you know, a lot of people who've gone into recovery do so because they are in recovery themselves. And so they are passing on the information, the methods that they use to get sober, which typically is going to be 12-step programming, things like that. And so this isn't a conspiracy. They're just doing the thing that worked for them, assuming it's going to work for other people. And, you know, like I've been using this comparison a lot lately. So if you were obese and you got skinny the hard way, you know, you started counting calories, you gave up ice cream, you started walking, you started lifting weights, you did everything right, and you lost 100 pounds. And then this pill comes along, or this shot comes along. And all of a sudden, people don't have to do it the hard way. They don't have to struggle the way that you did. Don't you think you'd feel a little bit of resentment?
Mm-hmm. It's like Ozempic.
Yes. Yes. So, yeah. So I think it's multifaceted. Basically, there's all of these factors that have sort of come together to mean that this is just not a drug or a program that is well known in American culture.
Mm. Is it more popular, Katie, in any other countries in the world?
Finland probably the most popular, but it's still not the first line treatment. I think the U.S. will be. My hope is that eventually this will be, when anybody goes to their doctor will, you know, and complains about their drinking or reports that they have a drinking problem, that the doctor will start talking to them about medication-assisted treatment, whether that is naltrexone or other drugs for it, whether that's GLP-1s, which has, you know, anecdotally can be really effective for people in terms of not just cutting down food, but also cutting down alcohol. The Sinclair method has an added barrier to uptake, which is that it requires drinking, which is the thing that I think makes it so appealing for people, is also the thing that makes it dangerous. A clinician, it's going to be hard for a clinician to advise their patients to continue to drink, to continue to do the problematic behavior, not just because that's such an anathema to everything you learn in school and experience about continuing, you know, about how quitting works, how things work, but also because there can be legal issues here, right? So if you're a doctor and you tell your patient, take this drug and then have a drink, and then you go and you kill someone in your car, you know, is the doctor going to be legally liable for that? Possibly. So this is, because of that, this is really something that has spread not from doctors or from recovery professionals, but it's spread from patients. And that's what I think is so interesting about this drug and this program, is you're more likely to get good information about this from Facebook than you are from your own doctor. And there are not many things I would say that about.
Well, let's talk just a little bit about some of the criticisms of this drug and the Sinclair method more generally. I think one feeling that people have, and alcoholics can sort of never be truly and fully in control unless they are totally sober. And the idea that you can drink responsibly or moderately, you know, takes away from that understanding. What is your view on that? Because I think that is one response that people will have to this conversation.
Well, I am sober. So, gotcha. No, I think that's a valid concern, especially for the families of people who have suffered under their loved ones drinking. I just don't think it's a universal experience.
Like, you are sober, but there's a lot of people, I imagine, who kind of continue on this drug for a lot longer than 7 months.
Yes, that is absolutely
maybe forever.
True. Yeah, some people do it forever. Some people want to be able to drink one glass of wine and not the whole bottle. I've talked to enough people who have done this successfully that I know that it is possible to do that. The thing is, you do have to have some self-control. Not as much self-control as you have to just quit drinking entirely, you know, going cold turkey or whatever, or going through 12-step programs. But you do have to take your pill every time that you drink. And by the time someone has gotten to the point that they need this, medication, that they're seeking some outside solution to their problem, chances are that they do meet the risk factors for alcohol use disorder. Their drinking problems are legitimate and serious. And for people like that, you know, if you start taking your pill, if you stop taking the pill, you're probably going to slide back into problematic drinking, alcoholic drinking, within the span of months if you just stop taking your pill. And I have talked to lots of people who have done that. So that is a risk with this. Of course, that's also a risk with AA or any other treatment. The risk is always there that somebody is just going to backslide.
I think one of the other criticisms will be the sort of, well, let me just tell you how my producer, when we were talking about this conversation, something that came up between the two of us. Her dad has been sober for 19 years because of AA. He chairs AA meetings in his local jail and does all of these incredible things and is constantly getting people into recovery. And her point was sort of like, AA works because it's community-based. Mm-hmm. And there's really no way to replicate that in the world of the Sinclair method and this kind of miraculous drug that you've been taking. And that it is precisely the sort of model of having a sponsor and having mentorship in this world that has made it so sticky and perhaps like profound. And yeah. I wonder what you say to that.
Well, I think that she's right in the sense that that's one of the most valuable parts of AA is the community aspect, right? Because everybody needs other people. It's very unfortunate. Maybe addicts in particular, right? You need that support. You need that structure. You need a place to go. And AA provides all of that. You can also find that within Sinclair Method communities. So there are meetups. There are online meetups. There have been a small number of in-person meetups. Obviously, there's not one in every city the way that there is in AA. But the difference is that when you talk to people who organize the Sinclair Method meetups, their goal is not for people to continue to go to meetings 19 years later. Their goal is for people to go to meetings for as long as they need to and then to stop. It's not about forming a sort of new identity as a sober person. It's about getting over your addiction and getting on with your life. And that's what I find so appealing about it. But, you know, I'm the sort of person who doesn't particularly need meetups. I don't need community. I did this in secret. And it's just everybody.
I know, Katie, but then there's this kind of amazing plot twist in the book where you move across the country, mm-hmm. you know, you're sober, and where do you go to make friends?
Hey. Yeah. It didn't really work, by the way. I mean, I did go to meetings. I didn't make any sort of long-term friends. I did feel when I would, I still enjoy going to meetings, and I just moved again. And I've got the calendar pulled up on my phone, so I might start going again because it is a good place to meet people. I do feel a little bit of a fraud when I go to meetings because of how I got sober. But I am sober. I do belong there. You know, that's the valuable part. And I think that's a legitimate criticism. It's just that not everybody needs that. And that's kind of the whole point of the book is that we're all different. You know, another I'm anticipating what you would ask me next, which is about the spiritual whole. Was that the next question on the list?
Yeah, well, that is something that I was going to ask. But ask yourself the question.
Okay, so I knew that this was going to be a criticism. I knew this was going to be a criticism of the book and a question that a lot of people have, which is, you know, AA provides a spiritual experience, right? It's not about just quitting drinking. It's about filling the hole inside of you that needs to be filled, finding the reason that you drank in the first place, the fundamental thing that is wrong with you that made you turn to alcohol. And my feeling about that is just the idea that this is universal is just a myth. We don't all have the same experience. Some people absolutely do have that experience. They do have some, you know, spiritual desire, some spiritual need, and AA fills that. The 12 steps fill it that. But that's just not my experience. And I know that's not the experience of a lot of other people because I've talked to them. The reason that I drank is not because I was anxious or depressed or because I had trauma. The reason I drank is because I started at a young age and I did a lot. And I have a genetic predisposition towards alcoholism. I have those three risk factors. It was a learned behavior for me. I drank my way into alcoholism. I have a twin sister. She didn't drink her way into alcoholism. We're not that different. We had different experiences in life. I drank more than she did, and I developed an addiction. And so for me, I think that it's a bit of a pernicious myth that there is something deeper inside of all of us that needs to be fixed. It's just not always true. Mm. You know, I think with other drugs, people sort of realize this. Like, if any of us were, you know, given fentanyl enough times, we're going to develop an addiction. That doesn't mean that you have a deep spiritual hole that needs to be filled. It means that you were given a highly addictive substance and your brain developed a dependency on it. But we think alcohol is somehow different.
Do you think, Katie, that the sort of openness that we're seeing in the culture to Ozempic will make people open to the Sinclair method and drugs like naltrexone?
Yes, I do. And I think that medical establishments, public health, they've also sort of changed their tune on this. So I don't know how things are during the Trump administration, but under the Biden administration, there was a turn in public health agencies, including in the government, towards harm reduction. And harm reduction is a term that I think has gotten sort of a bad rap because people think of it as like injection sites and people not going to prison when they're doing open air drug use in Seattle and San Francisco. But harm reduction is a much broader concept than that. And this certainly falls under that rubric. If the goal is abstinence only, you are going to lose a significant part of the population that is unwilling to be abstinent. And that's the population I think naltrexone and the Sinclair method particularly can target. The people who want to take control over their drinking, who want their lives to be better, who want to be better themselves, but who cannot, for whatever reason, completely quit right now. There's a lot of people who fall in that category.
Katie Herzog, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.